Last year, Congress passed a similar bill. I kept my promise by vetoing it. And today, I'm keeping my word again. I'm vetoing the bill that Congress has sent.
President George W. Bush just moments ago vetoing yet again federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. We're going to be talking with Dr. David Prentice here in just a moment about that subject as the news breaks. Also, the president issued earlier today an executive order having to do with research into other stem cell research or funding for other stem cell research. We'll find out what that was really all about. David Prentice will be our guest here in just a moment. When we conclude our conversation with Dr. Prentice, you've heard the story, and we'll play it for you. CNN, a story about the U.S. military's interest in what was called a gay bomb, apparently some sort of a chemical dispersed upon the enemy that would make the enemy irresistible to one another. That is, the soldiers on the field, largely men, I imagine, irresistible to one another, inhibiting their ability to fight. What do you make of it? Should homosexuality be used as a weapon? Is all fair in love and war? I want your answer to that question in a few minutes after our conversation with Dr. David Prentice. Dr. David Prentice is a regular guest, and he's a senior fellow for life sciences for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. Dr. Prentice, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be back.
Let's talk first about the veto since that happened most recently. What exactly has the president said no to, and can his veto be upheld?
What the bill would have done is expand funding for essentially more destruction of human embryos, provide an incentive to destroy more embryos. It's basically the same bill that he vetoed last summer. He had promised to veto it. He did. It doesn't look like Congress has the votes to override this, so we're basically looking at political theater in this case.
And then, if you would, what was the nature of the executive order that the president signed earlier today?
Well, it's an interesting order. National Institutes of Health at this point has what they call the embryonic stem cell registry. It's those cells that were approved for funding, federal funding, back in 2001, although derived from destruction of human embryos. Of course, at that point in time, his point was the embryos had already been destroyed. Here are some cells, here are some money, let's see what you can do. Of course, nothing's really come of that, and what he's done with this executive order is to say there are other sources for these pluripotent or flexible types of stem cells that can form virtually any tissue, and we want to open it up for those. So he's renamed it the Pluripotent Stem Cell Registry. We'll start to see sources like amniotic fluid, cord blood, even bone marrow, and other types of stem cells that have proven to be just as flexible as the embryonic stem cells, and start to see some more money flow in that ethical science direction.
So this executive order issued earlier today by the president does involve funding for these alternate sources of stem cells?
There's no specific dollar amount put for it, but he has indicated that the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Director of NIH should look in that direction towards coming up with these types of cells that have that flexibility but don't involve creating, destroying, or harming human embryos. So we saw another example of that just a couple of weeks ago. Three different groups, two in the U.S. and one in Japan, showing that they could take just an ordinary skin cell from a mouse, add four genes, and turn it into this flexible type of stem cell, essentially indistinguishable from embryonic stem cells, but now without using embryos, without using eggs, simply taking a skin cell and turning back the clock on it.
Dr. Prentice, I'd like your response to some things that have been said by opponents of the president's veto and his position on federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. This is Sean Tipton. He's spokesman for the Coalition for Advancement of Medical Research.
America's patients with diabetes, with Parkinson's disease, with Alzheimer's disease are not going to be fooled by this political fig leaf that the president has issued today. It's not a change in policy in any way.
How do you respond?
Well, let's first go down that list of diseases. Alzheimer's, we have the proponents of destructive embryo research continuing to bring up a list of diseases, including Alzheimer's, which back several years ago, after President Reagan's death, was pointed out in the Washington Post, no less, by Alzheimer's experts that stem cells were not going to treat Alzheimer's. And in fact, the quote was, it was a fairy tale to believe that. As far as these other diseases, diabetes, last month we saw the story that adult stem cells were treating juvenile diabetes. Parkinson's, we have several patients who've been treated with Parkinson's with adult-type stem cells or stimulating their own brain adult stem cells right inside their head. There are dozens of diseases where adult stem cells have already helped patients. And by continuing to put forth this list of diseases that they claim embryonic stem cells might, possibly, someday treat, they're really deceiving these poor patients.
Okay, the other point that was made by Tipton was that this is not a change in policy for the president. Nothing's changed. He called it a political fig leaf. How do you react?
Well, it's hardly a political fig leaf. As we've said, this is political theater primarily foisted on us by those in Congress who support destruction of embryos in this research. The change in policy primarily is saying, look, we recognize there are other sources of these very flexible stem cells besides embryonic, and you can get them without killing the donor. You can get them in an ethical manner, and we need to be focusing on these other sources.
Here again is Sean Tipton, again, spokesman for the Coalition for Advancement of Medical Research. He says that the president's veto simply isn't pro-life.
It seems to me the pro-life position is to try to enhance the lives of the people who are existing now, lives of people who may have been shattered through a spinal cord injury, who may be devastated by developing diabetes or cardiovascular disease.
What do you make of his definition of pro-life, Dr.
I think that's a false definition. And again, he's trying to say that embryonic stem cells somehow are now or soon will treat these diseases. Let's just go back to those diseases. You know, he mentions diabetes. We said we've already treated them with adult stem cells. Cardiovascular disease. There were patients there in the East Room of the White House who had congestive heart failure who are now having basically normal heart function treated with their own adult stem cells. And again and again and again, the proponents of embryonic stem cell research keep pointing to all these diseases, where in the meantime, the scientists themselves note that it will be decades, if ever, before they might treat a single patient. In the meantime, the adult stem cells, cord blood, these ethical sources where the donor's not killed, are already treating patients today, and their health is improving now.
The proponents of embryonic stem cell research have, political and otherwise, have sworn as late as today, especially in light of the president's second veto here, to keep pushing. Two final questions. Why such a push for federal funding for embryonic stem cell research and its the destructive research that's done here?
Well, in terms of why federal funding, people want a place at the trough, if you will, those who are doing this kind of research. They've actually already got federal funding available, something like $130 million over the last few years for just human embryonic stem cell research. And what have we seen come of that? In fact, over 25 years of embryonic stem cell research, very few mice helped, and certainly no patients. Again, holding out false hope to these poor patients.
And finally, then, why hasn't private sector money rushed into the alleged vacuum for funding for embryonic stem cell research, Dr. Prentice?
Well, it's interesting. When you bring up the private sector and those investors, their money's going to adult stem cell research. And the answer is very simple. It's because the adult stem cells are working and the embryonic's not. And so they're after, then, the taxpayers' funds.
FRC.org is the website address for the Family Research Council. Dr. David Prentice is a Senior Fellow for Life Sciences for the Family Research Council. They're based in Washington, D.C. Keep up the good work, and thank you very much for your time this afternoon and for being our guest.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Issues Etc. is committed to help keeping you informed on life issues. It's a partnership, however. We do the running down of the guests and the choosing of the topics. We try and keep on top of the news as we have this afternoon with the president's veto. But it is a partnership, on not only between you and us as listeners, but we need your financial support as well to help us defend life from beginning to end, especially as we approach the end of our fiscal year, which is the end of this very month. June the 30th would be the last day of this fiscal year. Right now, we're about $36,000 short of a total $240,000 annual budget for the weekly nationally syndicated edition of Issues, Etc. Your gift in this last few days of our fiscal year enables people to hear Issues, Etc. on almost 100 radio stations around the country and worldwide on the web. So please consider a tax-deductible gift here in the last days of our fiscal year, right before June 30th. That's our deadline for that $36,000 shortfall in our $240,000 annual budget for the weekly syndicated edition of Issues, Etc. You can donate online. Our website address, go there tonight and look for the Give Now button, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. You can use our resource line. It's 24 hours, and it's ready to take your calls, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or you can always write us, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your generous support here in the final days of our fiscal year for Issues, Etc. I asked the question before, and I'm going to ask it again. In fact, we've been kind of chomping at the bit to do this one, but one thing pushes out another. The gay bomb. The story is, and we'll have it for you here from CNN in just a moment, story is that the U.S. military took some interest, it's debated how much interest, in a so-called gay bomb for use in war. Now, we're a nation at war. And the old saying is, all is fair in love and war. All sorts of concepts for weapons have been proposed over the history of warfare. And in this case, the Pentagon was looking for non-lethal ways of dealing with the enemy, incapacitating the enemy, and attenuating their ability to fight. Now, as you listen to this story, I want you to think about this question and then be ready to give us your answer on the other side. Should homosexuality be used as a weapon? This would, if it worked, the gay bomb would cause the enemy soldiers to be amorously attracted toward one another and to engage in homosexual thoughts and activities, and then they wouldn't be able to fight. That was the theory, of course. So, do you approve of essentially causing someone to sin to win a battle or a war? Or, since war is war and it is what it is all fair in love and war? Do the ends justify the means? At least in this case, because, you know, some would say on the battlefield, you do what you have to do. Our phone number, 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. We're coming to you live this Wednesday, June the 20th. We're going to hear some audio from CNN on the U.S. military's interest in a gay bomb. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Should homosexuality be used as a weapon by the U.S. military?
In the long history of war, it may have been one of the craziest, downright laughable ideas, a so-called gay bomb.
The idea was that if soldiers suddenly all became irresistible to one another, that unit morale and cohesion would break down and the enemy would be unable to resist.
The idea of a non-lethal chemical bomb containing aphrodisiacs was among nearly 200 proposals the Pentagon received in 1994, this one from an Air Force lab in Ohio. It pitched what it called a distasteful but completely non-lethal example, especially if the chemical also caused homosexual behavior. The Defense Department says it had all the ideas reviewed, and that the gay bomb proposal was among those not making the cut. The Pentagon released a statement saying it never investigated the concept. It was just one individual putting together a concept paper with a variety of examples that were rejected. But members of the California watchdog group Sunshine Project don't buy that.
When the Pentagon says that they rejected this proposal, it's simply not true, and we have the facts to demonstrate that they've continued to think about it and to consider it in the years since it was first raised.
In San Francisco's Castro District, the idea of a gay bomb, whether considered or not, was good for some laughs.
Do they really think that, like, faced with, like, guns and, like, being killed, they're really going to choose sex?
People still have such a misunderstanding of sexuality in general, not just homosexuality, but sexuality in general, that they think that it could be used as a weapon. Like, when has that ever worked?
Sagar Meghani, The Associated Press, Washington.
Well, you know, I think it's if you've ever studied the history of warfare, military exploits, you know that sex and war go together. They really do. There was an awful lot of, if any of you remember, during the Second World War, there were efforts on the part of the Nazis to infiltrate U.S. troops with prostitutes. It also happened in the Vietnam War. It also happened in the Korean War. It was a way of getting secrets, compromising the enemy. It was a way of demoralizing the enemy, or even perhaps spreading disease among the enemy. So in the end, they're unable to fight at full effectiveness. Now, the gay bomb was an idea, apparently, at least according to the Pentagon, never anything more than an idea. Was it a good idea? That's the question. Is all fair in love and war? I want your answer to that question. 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Our in-studio email address this Wednesday, the 20th of June, issues ETC at KFUO.org. Now, war is like any of these big subjects. Everybody has an opinion on this. I just want to hear yours. It was back near September 11th when we raised the issue of torture. Is torture justifiable in a time of war? Well, here's something that doesn't do any real physical harm, I guess we could say. Doesn't do any real physical harm. It was considered as among the other possibilities of a non-lethal weapon. And there are all sorts of these things. Non-lethal weapons to be used in warfare. A chemical agent dispersed among the enemy that would make the soldiers attracted to one another and inhibit their ability to fight at their best effort. Good idea, bad idea? Do you think homosexuality should be used as a weapon? Since this would, if it worked, if it really worked the way it was intended to work, if the gay bomb actually produced homosexual feelings, attractions, and behavior among the enemy, do you approve of essentially causing someone to sin on the battlefield to win a war? Give it some thought, then give me a call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. I mean, heck, when it comes to the non-lethal weapons that have been considered or perhaps even tried, they got the sound waves, they got lights. Remember when Noriega's compound was being besieged back in the 80s? They played, what did they play? It was either heavy metal, it was disco. I think it was disco music as a weapon to disorient and essentially drive crazy your enemies. These were all the military has become very efficient at using these non-lethal tactics. In order, I don't know if they're tactics or strategies. I never kept those two things straight. But all these methods to try and deal with the enemy short of killing them. So what do you think about the gay bomb? DB is calling from his car. Hi, DB.
Hey, Todd. Of all the things you've had on the radio, I thought twice about calling in on this one, but it is a good question. I think the concept probably is ridiculous, and I doubt that it was actually considered by the Pentagon. But at the same time, if you think about it, I think that, just looking from a Christian perspective on the issue, that there are legitimate times for just war. And we know that often the war that often is going to mean the killing of the enemy, and there are times when that is legitimate, even though it's a great evil, it's something that God's permitted us in our fallen world. But I think if this tactic was actually possible, we would be causing or at least encouraging people to participate in activity that we believe is sinful. And I think that would be something that would be worse than evil committed than we have to kill in war. So I see this more akin to, I think it was Balaam who was encouraging the enemy to lead the Israelites into sin. I see this in that kind of category.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, DB. Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, what about the rest of you? The gay bomb would, if it worked, turn the enemy on itself, not in hostility, but in affection, homosexual behavior. You know, it would serve to confuse, distract, all those kind of things you want to do with your enemy when you're engaging them in battle. 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. These issues have come up when it comes to homosexuality in the military before, because the argument, remember the argument of don't ask, don't tell, was it would probably have a corrosive effect. If a person's sexual orientation were known in a wartime situation, on esprit de corps, on the camaraderie, and on the ability of people to fight as a unit. So we have don't ask, don't tell, which is, if you are, don't tell us, and if you are, we won't ask, and if you are, we won't pursue. It was don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue, and the goal here was, it's probably better kept a secret in the military so that we can fight effectively than it is to have it openly discussed in the military. And, of course, don't ask, don't tell has been the subject of a lot of controversy ever since it was first adopted as a policy. This is kind of the opposite of don't ask, don't tell. It's cause homosexual behavior among your enemies in order to hopefully defeat them or rob them of their ability to fight. A good idea? Should homosexuality be used as a weapon? Kathy calls from St. Charles. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Yeah, I have a high school son who's just graduated and started working, and his comment was, when he got home from work, was that he said, well, that's about stupid. He said that you go from having them want to kill our soldiers to want to capture them, torture them sexually, and then kill them. He said they're not necessarily going to turn on themselves.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, the law of unintended consequences. Good thought. Teenagers sometimes come up with some bright ideas. Phil's calling from his car. Hi, Phil. All right, we'll get Phil back here as soon as we can. You think it's a good idea, a bad idea? Let's see what Selena has to say, calling from her car. Hi, Selena.
Hi. I have a really kind of a strange thought that came to mind when I started talking about this, or when I heard you talking about this, is what, can't get this thought out here, why are they thinking that they can produce this sensation in people if it is a God-given gift, which they are supposedly claiming that homosexuality is?
You know, our listeners are just so much brighter than we are. We would never come up with this stuff on our own. Selena, thank you very much. Right. The proponents of homosexuality, and even some who aren't, would say, hey, I was born this way. It's God's gift, and this is something God has produced in me. So it is a good question. Why would, if it could be done, why would that make any sense, given if you could produce it artificially? More of your phone calls and your email on the gay bomb coming up. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio. The break's a great time to call and to email. We're coming to you live this Wednesday, June the 20th, talking about the gay bomb. It's a chemical agent that, if it were used, it would turn the enemy homosexual. Or at least, if it worked, it would. Is it a good idea? We'll be right back with more audio open lines right after this.
Where Christianity meets culture. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Deaconess Pam Nielsen, Senior Editor at Concordia Publishing House, on the Christ-centered cross focus of Growing in Christ, the new Sunday school curriculum from Concordia Publishing House.
We've been very intentional in one, teaching the scriptures. We are concerned about Bible literacy. Pastors tell us they get kids in confirmation that they don't know any of the Bible stories, they don't know any of the Bible people. So we're trying to teach the Bible stories, the who, what, where, and when. But we're teaching them in the context of Christ. And every story, every week, be it Old or New Testament, connects to Christ as the Savior.
For more information about Growing in Christ, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or find the Growing in Christ logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. It's a Christ-centered, cross-focused Sunday school curriculum, Growing in Christ.
Days or years, what's the difference?
Answers with Ken Ham, co-author of the new Answers book. Ken, does it really matter whether God took days or years to create the universe?
Actually, what really matters is believing what God has already told us. Of course, God could have taken 6,000 years, 6 years, or even 6 seconds. But the point is, it's not what he could have done, it's what he said he did. And if you accept the clear meaning of the Bible, God tells us, in no uncertain terms, he created the universe and all life, including Adam and Eve, in 6 24-hour days. Of course, God, an infinite being, could have created everything in no time at all. So why did he take so long? God tells us in Exodus chapter 20, verse 11, quote, "In 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested on the seventh day." You see, he worked for 6 days and rested for one in order to set a pattern for us. And that's where our seven-day week comes from. It does matter how long God took to create the earth. We need to take God at his word when he plainly told us creation took 6 days, not millions of years.
This topic of the age of the earth directly relates to the question, if there's a God, why is there so much disease and suffering and death in this world? Discover more when you read Ken Ham's free booklet available on our website, AnswersRadio.com. And while there, find out more about our high-tech creation museum, AnswersRadio.com.
Have you ever considered why Christianity does not have more followers if the benefits of being a Christian are superior than what any other religion offers? Or is it that what other religions offer is superior to Christianity, at least on paper? On the next broadcast of Law and Gospel, we will examine what benefits other religions offer.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
Next time on the Bible study, we'll finish up Acts chapter 7 and move into chapter 8. Did you know that when Stephen passed away after he was stoned, that Jesus stood up to receive him into heaven? Do you think Jesus will stand up to receive you? Let's talk about it next time in the Bible study with Pastor Ken Wagner on our live 10:05 Bible study program.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AM 850 KFUO underwriter.
The idea was that if soldiers suddenly all became irresistible to one another, that unit morale and cohesion would break down and the enemy would be unable to resist.
Well, that was the idea behind the gay bomb, an idea proposed to the Pentagon. Apparently the Pentagon says they didn't take it seriously, although some doubt that. A non-lethal way of dealing with your enemy during war and attenuating his ability to fight. Is that the way we should go about it, using homosexuality as a weapon, essentially causing the enemy to sin so that you can defeat them in battle? What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's the last half hour of Issues, Etc. Audio open lines this Wednesday, the 20th of June. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Phil's calling from his car. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, Todd, you still there?
I am.
Okay, I was gonna say you bringing this topic up gave me a pretty good laugh because I see Dr. Evil putting that on Austin Powers, but to be serious about it, I would really have a problem going along with some of your other callers of that. First of all, aren't we committing a sin by having the war to begin with, and then we're using something to cause our enemy to commit sins? Besides it sounding ridiculous, you know, I think most people would have a problem with it, or at least most Christians.
Phil, thank you very much for the call. Well, okay, laying aside the issue of whether or not the war itself would be wrong, think about it. If the enemy was attacking us, right? People were, let's say, for some reason, the Canadians, those crazy Canadians decide to invade. I mean, it's going to happen sooner or later. If our country was being attacked and someone dusts off the file of the way that we deal with our enemies, and there's the file, the gay bomb file, some sort of chemical agent that we disperse over the enemy and basically ruin their ability to fight by making them more interested in hugging and kissing one another than in fighting us. I know it does sound like the stuff of an Austin Powers movie. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if it weren't the genesis of the idea. However, it was at least proposed to the Pentagon. A good idea? A bad idea? It's audio open lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, so far, the callers are trending against the gay bomb. Now, I know that there are those, because I've talked with people, who say, look, it's war, and don't you understand, it's kill or be killed, and we use other means of deception. We use other means of confusing the enemy. We use other means that might even be cause our enemy to sin. We have other means of distracting the enemy. Why not this one? If it works, why not this one? What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our callers so far are concerned. Wouldn't want to see it happen, even if it were a plausible idea. See what Don thinks, calling from his car. Hi, Don.
Hello. Yeah, I think the whole idea is ridiculous. As militant as the gay movement is in our country, if they had some kind of technology to turn people gay, I think they'd be using it on us, against us.
All right, Don. I'm not sure I agree with your last point there, but Don seems to think it's not a good idea. No, the question isn't could it work. The question isn't would it work. The question is if it could. And if it did, would you approve of the military using homosexuality as a weapon during war? Bob's calling from his car. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well.
You said causing people to sin by hugging and kissing each other. Do you think hugging and kissing each other itself is a sin?
Well, no, I was...
Because some churches, people in churches, you know, will hug each other. People under certain circumstances of joy will kiss each other, even members of the same sex. Do you believe that's a sin?
No, Bob, I don't. I'm actually using those phrases, I hope you understand, Bob, because I'm on the public airwaves. And if I were to describe in detail what they were doing with one another, I wouldn't be properly dispensing the responsibility this microphone has bestowed on me. I mean, do you think, I don't know, I got two kids. I obviously don't believe hugging and kissing is a bad thing. I hug and kiss other men. No, not on a general daily basis. I can't say I've kissed anyone except maybe my dad when I was a little kid, a man. But and I've been known to hug a friend, not Jeff, never.
I tried, folks. I've tried. I used to try first year every night before he left. Give him a hug and a kiss.
Ain't going to happen.
And no,
I was out that door faster
cold
than...
Cold shoulder, and now I don't even get a goodbye. That's how this marriage is headed. Yeah. That's where it's going.
Exactly. That's how I treat my work wife. That's the way it is. No, Bob, I it was a euphemism. A euphemism. I think that's pretty clear. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Although Bob wasn't really very responsive to the question, was he? Let's see if Joe's better. Joe calls from his car. Hi, Joe.
Todd, sweetie, this is Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Hi. I think if we operate on the premise that we are fighting a just war, by definition our enemy would be fighting an unjust war. So in that sense, by fighting the war, we're causing him to sin anyway. So if the issue is, do I cause him to sin differently, I don't think it matters then. So I'd say if they can do it, go ahead and let them do it.
Okay, Joe, thank you very much. Okay, let me see if I can sort this one out. There's no such thing as a sinless war. The question has never been, is there such a thing as a sinless war? The whole theory of just war assumes that in war, sin occurs, and on a pretty regular basis, and that it doesn't question person's motives, but it really questions one's actions and intent. So there's no such thing as a sinless war. The question I've asked about the gay bomb is, if it were to work, would it be a good idea for warfare? Or would you have any moral qualms about using a so-called gay bomb during war on the enemy? We're not talking about spraying this over people's cities. There wouldn't be a lot of sense in that. But when you're on the battlefield, if there's something that could make everyone sleepy, right? The sleep bomb. Oh, we'd be using it. When we use things like, I think in the old days, things like tear gas, not going to kill you. Well, it could, but it's not generally going to kill you. But it will make you unable to fight. It'll make you want to run away and curl up in a ball. And we'll use that kind of stuff. I think it's a fair question. If we could induce homosexual behavior among the enemy, as the gay bomb proposed to be able to do, would that be like using the tear gas? Or the Wilkin idea, which is the sleep bomb. It would just be awful sweet, wouldn't it? They all just go to sleep. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us, issues, etc@kfuo.org.
I think some of our listeners had already had a taste of that sleep bomb today.
Absolutely. Maybe they dropped one outside. And we're protected within the bunker that is the KFUO building. It is much like a bunker, isn't it? I think it was built to withstand atomic attack. Well, continuing on the issue of homosexuality in the military, something that is not just a proposal but a policy in the military is Don't Ask, Don't Tell. One of the leading proponents of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, when he was serving in the U.S. Congress, was Bob Barr. Apparently, he's changed his mind. Here's the story from NPR.
14 years after the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was adopted, some people who once opposed the idea of gays in the military are changing their minds. Among them is former Georgia Congressman Bob Barr, who wrote in the Wall Street Journal this week that he's become, quote, deeply impressed with the growing weight of credible military opinion that allowing gays to serve openly in the military does not pose insurmountable problems for the good order and discipline of the services. Mr. Barr joins us by phone. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Great to be with y'all.
In the journal, you make the case that letting gays serve openly in the military is consistent with true conservative political philosophy. Talk a little bit about the conservative argument on the philosophical level for making this change.
True conservatives, and I do consider myself a true conservative. I'm very active these days with the Libertarian Party. But true conservatives purport to believe that one ought to advance and one ought to have those opportunities based on the merits of one's capabilities, especially in the military, which is supposed to be a meritocracy, and that does not mean that their advancement or their staying in the service should be dependent on their own personal sexual preferences.
And you suggest that a Zogby poll reports that the majority of returning servicemen from Iraq and Afghanistan are comfortable with gays in the military.
This is something that has impressed me greatly. Back when this issue was hotly debated in the early and mid-1990s, and even though I was not in the Congress at the time the initial policy was implemented, I came in shortly thereafter. But at that time, there was not a great deal of either factual study, historical study on the issue of how gays in the military would be perceived and worked with by others in the military. And what we're seeing in recent years is a growing and deep acceptance of gay men and women in the military, so long as they adhere, as all military personnel are required to do, to the rules and regulations regarding one's behavior, then those with whom they serve apparently are very comfortable with them serving and see no problem with it.
You also argue for letting gays serve openly as a practical matter. I mean, the services are just having a hard time recruiting. I want to quote what you say here. The military is firing badly needed, capable troops simply because they're gay and replacing them with a hodgepodge that includes ex-cons, drug abusers, and high school dropouts. That's pretty strong language.
I think we saw this very clearly illustrated in the Abu Ghraib scandal over in Iraq a couple of years ago. On the one hand, because of the don't ask, don't tell policy, we are removing people from the military or not even recruiting people with very important and high education level skills. And on the other hand, we seem to be continuously lowering our standards and bringing people in to meet the number needs of our military that really don't have the appropriate skills to handle the high-pressure jobs that we're putting them into.
Are you optimistic that the next president, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, will change the policy on gays in the military?
Based on those that took a position at the recent Republican so-called debate, I wouldn't say I'd be optimistic at this point, although even Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney seem to leave the door open a little bit. On the Democrat side, I'd say almost certainly the policy would be altered more in the direction of the liberalization and open policy.
Bob Barr is a former Republican congressman from Georgia. Thank you very much, Mr. Barr.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You know, that's a pretty significant shift, I think, to have somebody like Bob Barr, who was right in the thick of it when the whole don't ask, don't tell policy was being debated during the Clinton administration, to say, you know, on second thought, I think we should have open service of people of all sexual orientations in the military, and it's not going to be harmful at all. It's not going to be damaging. It was just months ago, General Peter Pace, he is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who equated homosexuality and adultery as both immoral, and he said, we don't tolerate one in the military, we shouldn't tolerate the other. And he had to retract. Well, he didn't retract. He had to go back and say, private opinion, my private opinion, because he touched on that one. I mean, he touched that issue, that is, why, if it's not immoral, for that matter, if it's not immoral, then why should the Military Uniform Code of Justice have anything to say about it? Why should military policy have anything to say about it at all? Unless it has some sort of harmful, detrimental effect on the military's ability to carry out its mission. And Bob Barr says he doesn't think so anymore. That's a pretty big change of mind. Do you agree or disagree? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You can email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Don't make me ask you for your favorite Green Acres character. Because when Matsit used to sit in this chair, what did he always threaten to do? Name my dog? Name my goldfish? I can't remember what it was. Don had something he always threatened to do. I've got a dog. She's already got a name. Goldfish is dead. Both my kids have been named. Monday, let's do this. Gay pride in Rome. Of all places, they're thinking about civil unions in Italy. And right there on the doorstep of Pope Benedict XVI, a gay pride parade. Let's hear about it. Story from BBC.
There was a carnival atmosphere in Rome as more than 100,000 people from all over Italy, many dressed in extravagant and colourful costumes, snaked past the ruins of the Colosseum on their way to a rally outside the Basilica of St John Lateran, a traditional rallying point for left-wing political meetings.
It is important to reaffirm all those rights that everybody deserves. Gays must be respected like every other normal person. They don't have anything more or less.
The head of the procession, Italy's best-known gay MP, Vladimir Luxuria. The march was deliberately channeled by the authorities to remain far away from the Vatican, situated on the other side of the River Tiber. Italian bishops are at loggerheads with the government over its promise to legalize same-sex unions. Most Italians now accept that gay civil unions are a fact and must be recognized by the law. No fewer than three government ministers took part in the rally. Italy's Environment Minister Alfonso Pecoraro Scanio said it was part of the fight for civil rights and compared the situation to the battle to legalize divorce in Italy over 30 years ago. Some local authorities have already moved ahead of Parliament in Rome to allow gay couples to register. The Catholic Church may have softened its attitude towards gays, but still brands homosexuality as an intrinsic moral evil. David Willey, BBC News, Rome.
I guess one might say if it could happen there, it could happen anywhere. In Italy? In Rome? Well, Monday, a former Muslim named Ayan Hirsi Ali, actually, who is a member, she was speaking to the National Press Club. She's a former member of the Dutch Parliament. You might have heard about her before. I think in a previous conversation with Uwe Simonetto, he's spoken of her and written about her several times. She's author of a book. It's actually an autobiography called Infidel. Miss Ali made some very strong statements about Islam. She says she no longer believes in Islam. She no longer believes in Allah.
The God that I was brought up with is a ferocious, aggressive God who in detail works out, is very totalitarian, works out in detail how I should lead my life and denies me all that I now consider to be my basic rights.
Now, bear in mind that Miss Ali is not speaking as a former radical Muslim. She was a member of the Dutch Parliament. She would have been considered on the whole spectrum of Islam to be moderate to liberal Muslim, I think. Certainly an advocate of human rights. Eventually, what she had to part with Islam in order to remain an advocate of the rights that she has been fighting for. Ayan Hirsi Ali says that she has become an atheist since renouncing Islam.
Having left that God, I think, dear Americans, you understand that I'm not really tempted to go back into the fear and what I consider the irrationality of a hereafter, hell and heaven, angels and spirits, and gardens and snakes and apples.
Although I would, there's a lot there. It shows how Islam, a false religion, could kind of spoil someone for considering the truth. Islam as a distortion of those truths she was naming there. The devil has his way both ways in this case, doesn't he? If he keeps you in Islam, he has you believing a lie under the guise of the truth, with a lot of the same props and furniture of the truth, but it's a lie. And if you're like Ayan Hirsi Ali and you decide to give up on Islam and become an atheist, he has you that way too. You reject the whole notion of God, a hereafter, period. Out of the frying pan into the fire. Ali says that Islam is spreading because Muslims aggressively seek converts.
Allah is the only God in town. The Christians have stopped, or at least have decreased their missionary work.
Now, that's interesting, too. Think about that. Into the vacuum rushes the proselytizing efforts of Islam. Let's make no apologies for the fact that Christianity is a proselytizing religion. We're not come and see. We're not if you'd like to perhaps consider. Christianity is aggressively, not in terms of force, not in terms of coercion, but aggressively proselytizes. It goes out intentionally, fully aware of what it's doing to proselytize. I know proselytize is a term that has taken on a decidedly negative connotation. It comes straight from the Bible, where converts to Christianity are called proselytes, people who have been proselytized. It does not seek to make converts by force, but to, as Jesus would say, make disciples by baptizing and teaching. But there's no doubt about it. Jesus was all for the proselytizing. He was all for, now we say, witnessing, and witnessing has even been dumbed down even farther to sharing. Now we share rather than witness. Or we share rather than preach. Now, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, a former member of the Dutch Parliament and author of this book, Infidel, it's her autobiography, speaking at the National Press Club, says that Christians aren't seeking converts anymore.
Christians have been inhibited and don't do that because they believe that that's not something good to do. So the only people who are doing it now, and I mean really a powerful movement who is doing that, is Islam and the agents of Islam from Saudi Arabia to Tehran. They're investing a lot of money.
What an indictment. What an indictment of Christians. Here she is speaking to the National Press Club saying, look, I used to be a Muslim. I'm not anymore. I'm not interested in any kind of a religion. And why is Islam spreading? She says, because of a failure of Christians to proselytize. They're just not interested in making converts anymore. They think that's a negative thing. Amazing. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, she's a former member of this Dutch parliament, and again, speaking at the National Press Club, says that Islam oppresses women and has been spread by violence.
The Quran is not a great book. It is reactionary and it's full of misogyny. And the Byzantine emperor's analysis of Muhammad was accurate. He did spread his faith by the sword.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. It's nice to hear someone admit it. Again, it's a former Muslim admitting this. She also says that Islam, of all the religions in the world, is not a religion of peace, as so many even here in the United States claim it is. It's not a religion of peace, but Ayaan Hirsi Ali says it's a religion of intolerance.
In Muslim lands, Jews, Catholics, and Protestants cannot have their own schools or churches or graveyards. If Muslims can proselytize in Vatican City, why can't Christians proselytize in Mecca?
And two quick final cuts. She also says that Islam, she's glad to be out of Islam. And again, she's speaking at the National Press Club, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, author of the book Infidel.
I travel from country to country to testify from experience and observation that Islamic dogma creates a cult of death, a cage for women, and a curse against knowledge.
Pretty harsh indictment of both Islam and of Christianity. Why is Islam growing? Christianity stopped proselytizing, stopped doing what Christ sent the church to do. You know, we ask a lot on this program, why is Islam growing? Why is Islam spreading? That's an answer we haven't gotten yet. I think it's a good one, though. At Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, they know what the mission of the church is, and they know that the mission and the message are the same. The gospel that we have is the gospel that we proclaim of Jesus Christ and Him alone crucified for sinners, and that's what sets us apart from Islam and all other world religions. Find out more about Concordia Theological Seminary and what they're doing to train pastors to preach that gospel boldly in the 21st century. You'll find them at our website, issuesetc.org. You can give them a call, too. 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.